Get ready for Ready Radio with Doug and Amy. It's emergency preparedness for everyone. Brought to you by TruPrep. For all your prepping needs, visit TruPrep online at truprep.com or visit a TruPrep store in Roswell or Marietta. Listen in as Doug and Amy provide helpful tips on how to get ready for anything that comes your way. And now, your hosts, Doug and Amy.
Welcome, everybody. You're listening to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy. We have a very exciting topic for you this week. We're going to be talking about the Ebola outbreak in Western Africa and the implications of this outbreak for not only people who are in the affected area, but also for people in America and people in Europe and all over the world as we look at what could happen and talk about some of the great pandemics from history, including the 1918 flu pandemic and all of the trouble that can come from a runaway virus. We're very complacent these days. Pop culture kind of touches on the idea of an outbreak or pandemic. We have movies, we have all sorts of things that, you know, books that are written that touch on the idea, but it's kind of like, you know, writing about the boogeyman or reading Jurassic Park. Yeah, you know, you can be scared of the velociraptors, but you're not really afraid of going out your door and running into one. It's just fun. It's just fancy. And that's what a pandemic has become, when the truth is that a pandemic is going to happen again. This is just as certain as an asteroid hitting the Earth in the future, just as certain as a solar flare hitting the Earth sometime in the future. We will have another catastrophic pandemic of a virus or bacteria that we cannot medicate for. It will happen for certain. Sometime in the future of human history, there will be a time when another virus comes out that we can't stop in an instant, and it will spread like wildfire. It has happened before. It will happen again.
Yeah, and that's a scary thing, Doug. You know, obviously, neither you nor I have ever lived through something like that. The probably the closest thing that I've ever gotten to it, you know, becoming realistic was when my husband and I got to go to Scotland, and we went to Edinburgh, and we went down to something called Mary King's Close, and it was actually absolutely fascinating, and just kind of hear the history and things behind that. But the entire city of Edinburgh was built on top of the original city, which I had no idea you could do that, but it was really interesting. The majority of the underground was closed, and you do not have access. But Mary King's Close was a little place for tourists that you could go down and see, you know, and, you know, kind of get a picture of history. But a big part of that was when they talked about sort of the pandemic that came through and just all the Black Plague and how it was they finally figured out was being spread, I think, through the
fleas.
Exactly. But they had like all these, you know, big coats, and they had, you know, in, like a little museum where you could see what the doctors used to wear, and it was just absolutely fascinating.
Well, you know, and it's interesting that you bring up what the doctors wear, because that's one of the reasons the pandemic of Ebola is spreading so quickly. I mean, Ebola is a fairly well-understood virus, and you would think that we wouldn't have this much trouble with it. This Ebola outbreak that's going on right now, Amy, is the largest Ebola outbreak in human history. Mm-hmm. There are more people who have died from this Ebola outbreak than the other Ebola outbreaks. Right now, we are right on the cusp of hitting 700 fatalities from this outbreak, which, in the grand scheme of things, is actually not that much. You think about how many people die from the flu each year, and it's tens of thousands of people just in the U.S. alone. But here we have 700 people. So why are we more afraid of Ebola than we are the flu? Well, the reason is that the flu fatalities are people who are usually at end of life. They're either very young or very old, or in some other way, they have a disability that prevents them from recovering from it. We all have had the flu. We all get over it. We all do our, you know, 2 or 3 days of being ill, and then we get back up on our feet and go, wow, that was terrible. Mm-hmm. I should really get a flu shot next year and move on. So we don't have the fear of it, whereas Ebola targets the healthiest. The healthier you are, the more likely Ebola is to strike you down.
I did not know that.
Because it plays off of your healthy system to wreak its havoc. Ebola is also called hemorrhagic fever, and the reason is because it starts off with symptoms that are very flu-like, vomiting, diarrhea, and then it morphs into this where you're actually having blood loss through your eyes and through your nose as blood vessels rupture and pour out, and you literally die from lack of fluids. The only way to really treat Ebola, because we don't have any antivirals for it, we don't have a vaccine for it, when no antibiotics are going to touch it because it's a virus, the only way to treat it is to keep pumping the person full of fluids continuously to try to keep ahead of the fluid loss.
So is that something that could, if someone were able to stay on top of it like that, is it something that would kind of run its course?
Eventually, yes. If there's not, the problem is systemic damage. You have blood vessels that are destroyed in the process, and you can get to a point where there's, it's like trying to pump water into a water balloon that has hundreds of little holes in it, and you just can't keep ahead of it anymore. But depending on how much damage there is, yeah, there you can treat somebody sufficient to get them through, possibly. And when Ebola first came out, the virus has changed. And this is another scary thing looking forward. And we'll talk about superbugs in one of the other segments. But when the virus was first discovered, it had around a 90% mortality rate, which is very, very high. Mm-hmm. Now the mortality rate has dropped so that only about 60% of the people who contract Ebola die. But the flip side of that is the part of it is better care because we understand what's going on and we have, you know, faster reactionary. And this outbreak is covering a wider percentage of population, which means that there are more health officials involved as an international community trying to prevent deaths. But it also shows that the virus is changing. The character of the virus has changed from being very, very high fatality rate to a lower fatality rate. And it's also changed its incubation period. The incubation period used to be less than 2 days, and now it's up to 3 weeks. Mm. So we need to think about the evolutionary pressures that we as doctors, physicians, and patients are putting on this virus. You know, as the virus's lifespan is measured in minutes or hours, not in decades like ours. So you can see multiple iterations of the virus change over just the course of a few days. And as the virus reproduces, replicates, dies, the viruses that are more evolutionary fit replicate more. And so if a virus found a host and killed the host within a day and did not transmit itself to a new host within that day, all the virus died, and it had no chance to replicate itself any further. Viruses that replicated slower, which may seem to be an evolutionary disadvantage because the faster you replicate, the more of you there are. But a virus that replicates slower passed from, instead of just going to one host and dying, passed to 7 or 8 hosts, and then they all passed to 7 or 8 hosts. Now you have a pandemic. Mm-hmm. And it's because that virus is less fit from a like an absolute perspective, but more fit in that it is passing its genes on.
So how is this actually spread then with the Ebola? Is it spread through human touch, human contact? Is it, you know, like if somebody sneezed into the air?
Ebola is a non-aerosol contaminant. It does not move through the air like a cold or flu does. You have to have bodily fluid touch bodily fluid.
Okay. Well, what about like water? And the first thing I'm thinking about is sort of like my water filtration. Will this one live in water or no?
Yes. If you had blood or vomit or something get into the water supply, it would stay suspended in there for probably several hours.
Oh, okay.
Now, it doesn't do well in sunlight. It doesn't do well outside of a host body, but it could survive if it was sufficiently moist, it could survive in that area for probably several hours. Mm-hmm. So, yes, that's another place where water filtration comes in, which is why you see it much more rampant in Western Africa than you do in Europe or Asia or the Americas, because we have better water supplies and cleaner water supplies. But the primary 99% of Ebola transmission comes from bodily fluid to bodily fluid contact. And so what you're having is you have somebody who's has vomiting or diarrhea. They have the virus on their hands. They touch somebody else. They touch and rub their eye. Most people will touch their mouth or their eye 15 times in an hour. Mm-hmm. About every 2 minutes, you touch your eye or your mouth.
Yeah, I'm touching my mouth right now, actually, as you're saying that.
And that's the most common vector for spreading contagious disease is for the human touch. If people would learn to keep their hands away from their face, actually learn to do that, you could eliminate probably 30% of all infectious disease transmissions just from keeping your hands off your face.
Right, and I think we do it, you know, without even thinking about it.
Well, it's human nature. It's one of our, it's a collective subconscious thing to touch our own mouths and eyes and face all the time. And it's natural. But that's something that these viruses, over all of the years that they have been around, have learned. I mean, if you're transmitted by air, that's like the pinnacle of transmission for a virus. But second, and almost as good, is transmit by touch, because for some strange reason, all of these creatures out there love to touch their faces. So if you are transmitted by touch, you do really well at being transmitted. Mm-hmm. And so those ones have flourished. You know, if you're transmitted by rubbing toenails together, those viruses have all long gone,
right?
Because nobody does it.
Right.
But that's why these viruses work, is because we do it all the time. And if we can change our behavior, we can eliminate a lot of the transmission of these viruses.
So are there any reports of this making it to the United States, or where is Ebola currently?
There has never been a reported case of Ebola in the United States, or to my knowledge, in the Western Hemisphere. Up until recently, every case had been in sub-Saharan Africa. But a couple of weeks ago, there was a reported confirmed case in Italy. Mm. Somebody had boarded a plane and flown to Italy, and they were discovered in Italy and contained. But for the first time, it's moved to another continent. And this is very scary stuff. Going into our next segment, we'll talk a little bit more about how air travel has changed the face of pandemics. You're listening to Ready Radio on News Talk 1160, The Talk of the Town.
And now, back to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy.
Welcome back, folks. When we left off, we were talking about how Ebola has moved from being a sub-Saharan African problem to being a world problem. And because of a vector moving into Italy, it's really changed the face of how we're dealing with this disease. It created a lot of panic in Europe, and the idea. And you have to understand that Europeans, as you said earlier, Amy, still have this cultural understanding of the Black Death. I mean, the Black Death was a huge impact on Europe and really the entire world. Before the plague hit, Europe was really overcrowded. They were facing starvation because there were so many people and not enough ability to produce food based on the land that they have and the farming techniques that they had at the time. They didn't have chemical fertilizers. They didn't have a way to increase yields. There was a limited amount of arable land, and there were a lot of people. And Europe was overcrowded, and it was becoming poor. It was becoming poor the same way that Africa is poor today, because there's so many people and so few resources, and the resources that were not being able to be readily translated into prosperity for the people there. And when you get to overpopulation, this is an inevitable result, is the crisis, the food crisis drives the economic crisis that comes after. So Europe was in this crux, and then the Black Plague, the bubonic plague, arrived, and this wiped out over a third of all the people in Europe, gone, which, of course, alleviated the food crisis and allowed them to catch up economically to be able to produce more food for, you know, with fewer acres of land and be able to support themselves. And it changed the nature of the way Europe progressed. It really allowed Europe to be more economically feasible with the land that they had at the time. But it was a horrible tragedy. Mm-hmm. I mean, the families ripped apart, death, and no one understood what was happening. Like you said, they didn't realize that it was fleas on the rats that was causing this. So they did everything under the sun. They quarantined towns, which is the best thing, but they also blamed cats. And there was a huge march to destroy all the cats in Europe, which, of course, let the rats flourish and increased the flea population and caused even more transmission of the disease.
Yeah, quite ironic.
You know the old nursery rhyme?
Yeah, ring around the rosy, right?
Yeah. What does it stand for?
Yeah, that's a they were, it says like pocket full of posies. So,
And they thought that posies would stave off the disease.
Right, exactly. And they said ashes, ashes, we all fall down. So it was a little kid's nursery rhyme, just kind of a way of, I don't know.
Coping.
Yeah, that's the word I'm looking for, coping with what was going on around them.
When you look at someone who has bubonic plague, you would have a rash, and around the rash would be a dark line. And so you would have a ring around the rosy rash. So they were talking about the visible effects of the plague. Mm-hmm. And then pockets full of posies. Posies were thought to keep the plague away from you. So people would walk around with flowers in their pockets to have fresh air, clean air, so they wouldn't be breathing the bad air. Ashes, ashes, they would treat the rashes that were itching and burning and terrible, they would treat them with a poultice made of ash to try to relieve the suffering. And then we all fall down. Mm-hmm. It was an acknowledgement that everybody died from it. Everyone who contracted it died. Mm-hmm. And this is a nursery rhyme that survives today. This is part of European cultural heritage to understand that a terrible pandemic can wipe through and wipe out massive amounts of the population. We understand this pointedly. And if you look at the history of Europe, the entire history of the continent was changed because of this pandemic. But this isn't the only pandemic that's happened in history. I mean, we've had pandemic after pandemic after pandemic, and they all change. They're all a little different, but they're also follow some of the similar patterns. What's changed between then, where it was slow spreading and hard to control, now it's incredibly fast spreading and impossible to control, because all it takes to switch a contamination point from sub-Saharan Africa to New York City is a 6-hour flight.
Exactly. Airline ticket will do it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you don't know you're sick, you're bringing this disease with you wherever you go. How do you stop that? How do you contain something that can move around the globe instantly? I mean, we talked about, remember the big bird flu scare?
I do.
What year was that?
That was a couple years ago.
Yeah, 2008 or 2010, somewhere in there. Yeah. Everyone was flipping out. H1N1. It was going to be the death of us all. And everybody ran out and bought what?
Oh, I don't remember. What were they buying?
They were buying those N95 masks.
Oh, that's right.
Home
I do
Depot
remember.
And
yeah, was it? Now, what about the swine flu? That was something else that came. Wasn't that the H1N1? Or was that the bird flu?
Bird flu was H1N1.
Okay, I got them mixed up.
But yeah,
I thought it was the swine flu that they renamed because it had nothing to do with swine.
Well, the reason that the birds and the swine are interposed and why these flus always come out of Asia is because if you keep domestic fowl with pigs, there's a high rate of transmission of the avian diseases to the swine. And then swine are so closely related to humans that the disease, once it makes a jump from a bird to a pig, it's easy to make the jump from a pig to a person. Mm-hmm. So the pigs create this like perfect in-between vector point that allows the virus to mutate just slightly enough to get into the pig and then just slightly enough again to get into the human. And the swine acts like an incubator to only allow the particular viruses in the virus family that are most adaptable to humans to survive in the pig, to get enough force so that it becomes communicable and then transfer to the handler. And then from that handler, it transmits through the community, and the next thing you know, it's global.
Right, right. And you're right. I mean, I think you made a really valid point. It was just with all the global travel, you know, that's going on right now. I mean, you know, I think we're realizing how small the world actually is. And people are, I mean, my husband travels all the time. My daughter, we actually have a German student coming in September. We're doing a little exchange. And my daughter is planning on going to Germany next July. And I really hope that this...
how old is your daughter?
She's 15.
What's the drinking age in Germany?
It's 16.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And she will be 16 by then. And
So you just headed that one off, but I guess not. She's got this all planned out.
Right. Exactly.
You have very smart children.
Well, the funny thing is, I mean, the teacher will be going with him, and she's already put her foot down, and she said, "Okay, let me tell you something. Let me tell you about the drinking age." But what's interesting is when the German students come over here, they have to be 18 to drive, and my daughter will have her license by then and be 16 and driving around. So I think that'll be interesting. So
wow,
there you go.
Okay, well, that talk about our famous bunny trails, that was definitely one of them. But yeah, people are moving around a lot, and the ability to hop on a plane, and as air travel becomes more and more commonplace, I mean, shoot, we just had a case come out of, I think it was the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals this week, that said air travel is a fundamental right under the U.S. Constitution. Did you know that?
I did not.
Yeah, because they were saying that the no-fly lists are the way to get off of a no-fly list is constitutionally bereft. It doesn't meet due process requirements. And the government turned around and said, well, what due process requirements do we have to say that you can't fly? And the Court of Appeals turned around and said, well, flying is a fundamental right connected to the fundamental right to travel. So if you're going to restrict it, then you have to have due process equivalent to a fundamental right, which is a huge burden for the government to overcome. Right. You have to show, because it's a governmental taking at that point. So you have to have a hearing, you have to have a judge decide, you have to all this stuff. Whereas before they were just, saying, well, we have some questions about you, therefore we're putting you on a no-fly list. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge change. But I mean, air travel, a fundamental constitutional right. How are we going to restrict people? Of course, now, if you have a disease, if we even suspect you of having a highly communicable disease, we can use due process to stop you from traveling. But this just illustrates how easy it is and how prevalent flight has become internationally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I used to live in a place where you could only get there by plane. That was it.
Right.
I mean, if you flew in, you flew out. That was it. If you didn't fly, that was it. I tried cases in Naknek, Alaska, which has the distinction of being the only place in the U.S. that operates a school plane.
Oh, my goodness.
They go over, fly over, pick up the kids, fly them back, school, fly them back home.
Huh.
Just like you have a school bus.
Yeah, interesting.
And it's not painted orange, yellow.
No, it isn't?
No.
Oh, it should be.
It should. It should be yellow. It should say school plane on the side right next to the windows. But I'm just telling you, I mean, the world has changed since the last big pandemic. And what was the last big one? Well, it was the flu pandemic of 1918, which was massive. I mean, everyone talks about the war casualties. The war casualties were nothing compared to the flu casualties of that year. Whole families were wiped out. People were terrified. People walked around with scarves and things over their mouth trying to prevent transmission. It was a huge deal. And it went in two waves. It flowed from Asia through America. And then America fizzled and it went into Europe, and Europe fizzled and it came back into Asia, and Asia fizzled and it came back into the U.S. It just flowed around the world for about a year and a half, making a slow circuit. Well, you know why it was making a slow circuit? Because it takes 8 weeks to get across on a boat.
Aha. Uh-huh.
But now it doesn't.
Nope.
Now you're not going to see this slow ripple effect go around the world slowly across and across. It's just going to be everywhere instantly. When we have a pandemic that is truly transmissible, when it's not like Ebola where you have to do bodily fluid to bodily fluid and where the incubation period is short, when it's a long incubation period. And the other thing about Ebola that's different than everything else is during the incubation period, during that 2 days to 3 weeks when they're asymptomatic, it's non-transmissible.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you can't catch it until they start having their fever.
Hmm, okay.
So here comes somebody, this was probably what happened in Italy. Somebody came over, they were getting off the plane, they were not feeling well at that point, but they hadn't been contagious at all. And then they ran a test on them and found out, yes, you have Ebola. Hmm. And they started massive treatment of this person and containment. We haven't heard anything out of Italy about any other cases. So it was contained in that one vector, but it was...
So was this recently? Like, how long ago
was
it?
I want to say it was less than 3 weeks ago.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it was very recently. Mm-hmm. I remember sitting in one of my favorite restaurants here in Atlanta, Perro's. I was sitting there watching the news that there was the first confirmed case of Ebola in Europe. Mm-hmm. And I thought about making that our topic that week to talk about this, but... when they were saying WHO was claiming that it was contained in Africa and this was an isolated incident, yes, it was a big deal that they had finally made it to Europe, but it was a single case and it's gone. It just didn't seem as important. And we do a lot of topical events here, but our focus is on, larger issues of preparedness, and these events illustrate preparedness. So a few isolated cases is nowhere near as interesting as this now pandemic, where it is the largest outbreak in human history with the most deaths. Folks, we're going to be coming right back. Stay tuned. You're listening to Ready Radio on News Talk 1160, the Talk of the Town.
And now back to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy.
Okay, welcome back. Doug, earlier in the show, you had mentioned, of course, we're talking about Ebola today, pandemics. And earlier in the show, you mentioned something about superbugs. To be honest, I'm not very familiar with superbugs, and I'm not, I guess, really familiar with the differences between, these pandemics and the superbugs.
Well, it's just like the difference, like a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the difference between a recession and a depression. A recession is when it happens to your neighbor. A depression is when it happens to you.
Right.
A regular bug is the one that happens to everybody else, and, there's a treatment, and everyone does their thing, and you're sick for a little while. Superbug is when there isn't anything you can do about it. And that's the danger that we're getting into. We're seeing more and more bacteria and viruses that are resistant to our standard courses of treatment. And some people say that we overused antibiotics. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not so sure about that. I think that this is natural. And it is a shame that our antibiotics are becoming less and less effective. But any use of antibiotics is going to do one of two things. It's going to kill off the majority of the infection. And two, it's going to create people who are more dependent on the antibiotics to have their immune systems function. So If you're looking at this, what are your choices? Okay, you've got antibiotics. We've discovered antibiotics. We know now about penicillin. We've had it. What are we going to do? People come in, they're sick. Now, if you treat them with penicillin or whatever, you are going to strengthen the infection's ability to evolve, because any pressure strengthens the survivors. Anything that doesn't kill you makes you stronger, right? This is actually an evolutionary principle. So if it didn't kill you and you've learned how to fight it, then you're better off. Now, we are in what's called a Red Queen's race. Have you ever heard that term before?
I have not.
Okay. The idea, it comes from, it's a logical shorthand that people use to describe certain events that are going on. And it comes from the story of Alice in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll, where the Red Queen was running in a race, and she was standing perfectly still. She was running as hard as she could, but she didn't move. And everyone with her was running just as hard as they could, but they never moved. And Alice said, "Why are you running so hard if you're not moving?" And the reply was, "Well, if you stand still, you get left behind." And that's what happens. See, we are in an evolutionary race with all of these viruses and bacteria in our environment. And so we are adapting, they are adapting all the time. And I don't care if you're a creationist, I don't care if you believe in the great spaghetti monster, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Evolution as a theory of origins is a theory because no one observed it. Evolution as a environmental change between animals and amongst animal groups is a fact. It is observable, it is provable.
Right.
You can see that things adapt, things change. Now, the question is are they adapting for the better or not? Because if they're adapting for the better, that goes against the second law of thermodynamics and entropy being in our closed universe. And entropy exists here and everything degrades over time. So,
but does it have to be one or the other? For the better or for the worse, or could it be both?
Well, it could be both. But I think that overall, if you look at it as a whole, it has to get worse over time because of ideas of entropy. I don't think that we are eventually going to evolve into super beings or that we're going to shed our mortal coil and be creatures of thought like in Star Trek.
Grow gills on the side of our necks and things
like that. Yeah, I don't think that that's... I think that over time, the entropy factor means that things get worse, which is why I personally find evolution as a theory of origins to be a hard swallow. Because if I look at the way things are going, I see that as things change, they tend to get worse, not tend to get better. And so it's hard to run the timeline backwards to say that, well, we started with single cells and then it evolved up to this level, only to watch everything start to fall apart now. And
could this just be more of a pessimistic view as opposed to optimism? Because there's really, I guess, ways to look at both.
Well, I think that it's more of a philosophical view. I mean, because of my morality and my religion, I have certain predispositions and things that I believe that this is true. And therefore, I'm looking at it through that lens. And I see things that fulfill my lens of religious viewpoint. And that may be good, it may be bad, but in the end, it really doesn't matter because it's my faith. So I look at this, and I don't see it as being pessimistic. I see it as just being a fulfillment of prophecy that things degrade over time. Things will always be getting worse until the end of time, whenever that is, whether that's in a million years or tomorrow, I don't know. But things are in a constant, you know, declining moral state and declining physical state after the fall of man. But that being set aside, we can all agree that evolution occurs in the present here and now as pressure is put on. So We introduce a new pressure on viruses or bacteria. We introduce penicillin, and penicillin kills off 99.9%, right?
Right.
Well, that 0.9% becomes the next generation of everything. And that 0.9% is the reason that it still exists is because penicillin did not work on it.
Right.
So now all of that generation of that bug is better off in relation to penicillin. Now, is it better off as a whole? No, because it's lost 99.9 of its comrades in the struggle to reproduce. But it is a stronger bug because of it. And we have been putting this evolutionary pressure on bugs for, 100 years now that we've had full-spectrum antibiotics? So that's been 100 years of evolution. Now, you say, well, shoot, 100 years of evolution in people, that's not much of anything. I can look back 100 years and people are basically the same today as they were then. Although people will say they're a little heavier set, and maybe they're a little taller because they have better nutrition. Also, there's higher rates of cancer and diabetes and other long-term illnesses, heart disease. And do you know why we have higher rates of these now than ever before?
Well, I mean, I think that's an entire show, actually.
It could be, but one of the real factors in it is that we're taking better care of people, right? I mean, people who develop, if the average life expectancy was 35 years of age, which at one point in Europe it was, if your average lifespan was 35 and most people develop type 2 diabetes at 46, how many type 2 diabetics are there going to be?
Well, it was rare.
Yeah.
Right.
So as you increase the life expectancy, these geriatric diseases become more and more commonplace. And so we're improving the bugs by putting evolutionary pressure on them, destroying all the weak. And we are degrading the human species as we go along by taking care of everybody and getting them and fostering them. And whatever's wrong with you, we fix, we take care of, we do that. And human beings are becoming more and more susceptible to disease, while the diseases are becoming stronger and stronger against our methods of defending from them. And we are creating this perfect storm where there is going to be a catastrophic pandemic. Now, I don't want to get into, should we be like throwing people on the hillside and watching them die? That's not the point. The point is just that as we, the more people that we take care of, which is a good thing in society, the more people who are going to be susceptible to a catastrophic illness. And that is going to lead to a day of reckoning when a lot of people get very, very sick and there's nothing that can be done about it.
Hmm. Well, isn't that just a cheery word of sunshine?
Yeah. I try to be cheery, yay. You know that. So well, what do you do about this?
Well, I think that's what we definitely need to look at is what do we do? Because, I mean, we don't want to just be, you know, the doom and gloom show. We are Ready Radio. It's all about being ready. It's all about emergency preparedness. And, of course, with our sponsors at True Prep, we want to look at and we want to give you some positive outlooks and some things that you can do.
Well, I think that the very first thing we should talk about, the very first thing, is your health. And your health is the very best prep you'll ever have. So accept that you're going to have a longer lifespan than your predecessors did. You're striving to live past 70 now. I mean, think about this. In the 1930s, the average life expectancy was 62 years of age. That's why they set the retirement age for Social Security at 65. It was only a safety net if you made it way past you were expected to live. Now, if you went up to someone and said, you know, I think you're not going to live past 62 today, they would be offended. Mm-hmm. They would say, well, right. Why do you think I'm going to die so young?
Right.
Well, it's not young. Mm-hmm. 62 is not young, but it is now. Mm-hmm. So you need to plan for living a lot longer than people used to plan for. And that planning for living, that means taking care of your body so that it lasts you that long. Otherwise, you're going to be in tough straits. If your body falls apart at 65, but you're kept on life support to 72, what a miserable existence. And you're going to be more susceptible to disease. So how do you fight that? You take care of yourself. You take good vitamins. You watch what you eat. And I'm not saying that you have to, you know, eat tofu every day. I'm just saying that if you look at your life as a whole, a healthier lifestyle with less processed foods, with less preservatives, with more stuff that you've grown yourself, that keeps you in touch with the land, touching back on these Jeffersonian principles, all of these things will make you a more healthy, better, fuller person. I mean, Jefferson lived to a ripe old age in his day. I mean, he was in his 70s in a time when the average lifespan was not even to 62, and he died rather quickly. It was something that was catastrophically wrong. He went downhill fast and he was gone. No suffering. Mm-hmm. And because he had lived a life that was, you know, in earnestly seeking a healthier lifestyle.
Yes, exactly. And well, although when you said earlier in the show that the Ebola was kind of hitting the healthier people. So, you know, obviously right now it's not here in the United States and we hope it never gets here. But this, when you look at heart disease and diabetes and cancer and all this kind of stuff, there really is something to say for, you know, being a healthier you when it does come to emergency preparedness. Because, I mean, when you are sickly, if something like the flu hits, is something that you had mentioned, I mean, that is something that does run rampant here. It's something that we would be able to, stave off. if the healthier we are.
Right. Now, the first aspect that I'm asking people to do is get prepared for being healthy in the body. And when we come back from our break, well, let's talk about being healthy in the mind and how the mind affects the body and makes you a healthier person. You're listening to Ready Radio on News Talk 1160, The Talk of the Town.
And now, back to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy.
Everybody, welcome back. When we left off, we had just finished talking about how having a more healthy body is important to staving off disease and illness and being ready for when the pandemic does come to the U.S. And something will. It may not be Ebola. It may be something we've never heard of. It might be Captain Trips, to steal a line from Stephen King. But whatever it is, we need to be ready in more ways than just one. We had talked about being physically ready and being as healthy as we can, but there's another aspect to be staying healthy, and that is the mental aspect.
Yes, it is. A healthy mind really makes a big difference, and it's actually been proven with stress tests. And when you have physical stress in your life, mental stress, it plays havoc on your body.
That's for sure. And I've seen that happen to people. I've seen people who have lived being miserable people, you know, where they do not find joy in life, and they have constant chronic health problems. Everything from diabetes to neuropathy sets in. I've watched people go blind from stress. As they have high blood pressure, which causes capillaries to burst in their eyes, and they've literally sacrificed their vision under stress, just because that they weren't able to let go and relax and to do what was best for them. And then I've also seen people who have been in that kind of stress have it reversed, have their physical ailments reverse on them when they were finally able to remove the stress from their lives. And it changed the way that their whole life was just because of stress. Stress affects you physically. It affects you emotionally, it affects you mentally, but it affects you physically. You can literally worry yourself to death.
Right, exactly. And that's more of like a long-term stress. If you have something, because there's like a short-term stress where you have that fight or flight mm-hmm. response. So like if somebody cuts you off or somebody jumps in front of your car, you know, it's sort of like an adrenaline rush and that's different. But when you have that long-term stress, it's
chronic.
Like if you have when you have a sick child that you're extremely worried about, maybe things aren't going well in a relationship, you know, there's a job, you know, job loss, things like that. And those are the things that just nibble at you and just eat at you.
Or maybe an economic collapse mm-hmm. or a long-term power outage.
Exactly. And you bring up an excellent point, because when we talk about emergency preparedness, and I have to remind myself often, because when we get into, you know, like you said, we don't want to be the doom and gloom, you know, radio show. But
I could be doom.
I'll be gloom.
There we go.
Yay. Nice. No, I don't like that. But anyway, but when you have these things, you know, and they're constantly nibbling at you, it really does affect. But we can't just be.
If, hey, I got to interrupt.
Oh, you've got the eyeballs. What?
You know, I have a Juris Doctorate, right?
You have a what?
Juris Doctorate.
Okay.
So yes. I have a Doctor of Law.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm doom, would that make me Dr. Doom?
Oh, no. Here we go. I think for the day, yes. You'll probably be Dr. Doom for the day.
I love it.
Great.
Listen, my minions.
Oh, do I have to be
prepare.
A minion?
Prepare! Anyway.
Well, you know, the thing is, listeners, do not get overwhelmed. I know that, you know, there is a way to become prepared, but do not get overwhelmed. I mean, when we look at all the different aspects of the things that could possibly happen, it's difficult.
I think what we're trying to illustrate is, and no matter how bad it is, eventually you have to have a little bit of levity, and you have to have a little fun, and you have to be able to laugh at yourself.
Yes. Yeah, I laugh at you every day. Oh, at yourself?
With me. You laugh with
yes.
me.
Yes, I laugh with you. Sorry.
Right.
I stand corrected.
There we go. So, anyway.
Where were we?
I was looking on monster.com for co-hosts, and you were...
There it is.
It's important. It's important to keep the right mindset going into preparedness, going into anything. And if you can find joy in your life, if you can find the place that makes you happy, seek it out, because it will make you healthier. And it will help you when the pandemic comes. It'll help you be a healthier person. Take care of your body. Take care of your mind. So then the last thing that we have to do is to actually start to prepare for something. I mean, if we are healthy in body and healthy in mind, when the the disease comes, we're going to be in the best possible place. Is it a panacea? Is it a guaranteed cure-all? No. But you're going to be better off than the miserably depressed person. You're going to be better off than the person who eats nothing but fast food every day. You're going to have a higher likelihood of survival. So how do we maximize that likelihood into the utmost? And that is by taking some simple precautions with things that we have on hand. If you don't have to go out in public as much during a pandemic, you're safer. So that means having food and water stored up so that you don't have to go to the grocery store where everyone is coughing and sneezing on you. I can't tell you how much disease I have prevented by staying out of the grocery store at peak times during cold and flu season. Mm-hmm. I go early in the morning to stay away from other people who are coughing and sneezing. I come home, I stay home, I stay out of public places. I try to stay away from places that are preparing my food during flu season so that people who have to go to work, and this is another thing that drives me nuts, is the people who have to go to work because they're paid hourly and they get no sick time. Every single job on earth should offer sick time without, I mean, I'm sorry, I'm not a big government person, but this should be an absolute fundamental requirement of law that every job must offer sick time. Mm-hmm. Because if you're sick and you come to work and you transmit it to 100 other people, you have just destroyed the economic uptick of you getting, that $9 an hour that we would have paid you to be there when you weren't actually there, compared to the 40 people who are going to miss 3 days of work because of it. Yeah. I mean, come on. This is no-brainer time. We should take care of people like that. But stay away from people helps. So, you know, quarantining yourself is a big deal. How do you stay out of society? Well, you've got to have the stuff you need at home. So you got to be prepared. It all comes back to being prepared. Then what do you do when you do have to go out in society? Well, you've got to take measures to keep you from inhaling things that are going to make you sick, the bacteria and germs. You keep from touching your face. You use hand sanitizers. Maybe you need a mask. And I think that this leads us to a really interesting product from True Prep this week.
Yes, yes. So the product of the week are the gas masks.
And they have a very particular gas mask on sale right now. It was made in Czechoslovakia. It's a copy of a U.S.-made gas mask. And what the Russians did during the Cold War is they looked at the U.S. mask and said, hey, we can make one just like it that takes their filters, but their mask won't take our filters. So if we need to pick up on the battlefield masks, we can use their filters, and they won't be able to do the same to us.
Huh.
Which
tricky,
is,
tricky.
Well, I mean, it's a long-standing thing with the Soviet Union. The Finns, when they were picking their armament, and Finland and Russia were in a heated Cold War before World War II, they chose to arm themselves with Mosin Nagant M9130s. And the reason was, is that's exactly what the Russians used. So they could pick up things on the battlefield, and their people would already be trained, and they could be able to use the same ammunition, and it was a standardized thing so that they could scrounge for materiel during the war. Well, that's exactly what the Russians did, is they made their masks compatible with U.S. filters so that they could scrounge during the war. Well, True Prep has these surplus masks, and now they're surplus, so they're not warranted or guaranteed, but they're still in the same condition they were at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And you can use not only the masks that you can get cheaply there, I think they're like $8 for a set of masks for the filter, or a set of filters for the mask, $8 for theirs, but if you came across a store or supply of the U.S.-made ones of the same design, they would still fit in the same mask, mm-hmm. so you could use theirs too. And this is a really brilliant thing. And they're selling them. I think that they originally were $30 a piece, and now they're selling a mask, a bag, and a set of filters for only $18.
Nice. Yeah, that's a great sale. And that's something, too. You know, these gas masks are not designed to physically live in. It's really to get you from point A to point B safely.
Or get you through Halloween with a
sure.
lot of fun.
Yes.
Going back to the mental aspect.
Okay.
They're kind of scary looking masks.
They are. Yeah.
They cover the whole face. They've got kind of goggly eyes. Mm. They're not the kind of masks from the Doctor Who episode from season one. They're more kind of green, and they've got big cheeks, so you look a little bit like you were out of Back to the Future.
Right. And they're a carbon filter, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So these, you know, if you do have to leave your home, and if there is, you know, say that there is a big pandemic and you just want to stay away from people, it would be used, you know, really to get from point A to point B. But there's other things you can do in your home also, which is, you know, putting up plastic over your windows, having like a place when you walk into the home. I've seen where they have like a wash, you know, people put like a wash station outside. You have to wash down completely. You walk into a little area that you have designed where you strip down and you put on new clothes before you enter the home. It might be a little extreme for some people. You know, it really depends on where your mindset is.
Well, and how much you're willing to live with. Do you know, at the very beginning, I hinted that one of the reasons that this happens in Africa as opposed to the U.S., one of the main reasons is because of air conditioning. Mm. The Ebola outbreak would not be as likely in America because of air conditioning. If you are in an American hospital and you're being treated for Ebola, do you have any idea what the average temperature is going to be in the hospital room?
I'm guessing 65, 70?
Yep. Low 60s in order to fight fevers. Mm-hmm. They keep hospitals rather chilly to fight fevers and to decrease the spreading of certain diseases. Some diseases don't do very well in cooler temperatures. Some, like the flu, do better. Some do worse. So, but in Africa, it's 110 and humid. So are you going to don a Kyvex suit and cover yourself head to toe in plastic?
I would not.
And so they don't. And then you have more spreading of the disease. So, I mean, lots of different factors go into this transmissions, and we can't be prepared for everything. We don't have unlimited time, we don't have unlimited finances, but we can take reasonable steps to be more prepared for a disease that's going to come, and it will come someday. So take our advice, stock up on good supplies, visit our sponsors at True Prep, check us out on Facebook and Twitter, and we will see you next week right here on News Talk 1160, the talk of the town.
You've been listening to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy. It's emergency preparedness for everyone. Brought to you by True Prep. For all your prepping needs, visit True Prep online at truprep.com or visit a True Prep store in Roswell or Marietta. Tune in each week as Doug and Amy get you ready for anything that comes your way. Ready Radio, Saturday evenings at 5, only on News Talk 1160, the talk of the town.